From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Verlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Civil and environmental engineer Jim Smith uses materials like clay, water, and sawdust to create ceramic water filters in rural South Africa.
You can teach local people how to make these filters. They can sell the filters in the community. That helps them economically, and then it also helps the community with respect to human health.
We'll have a conversation about water, sanitation, and health issues in developing countries. But first, Joshua Landis joins me to discuss the latest political and economic developments in Egypt.
Egypt is going bankrupt. It's a country of over 80 million people. You know, you look at the spreadsheet for Egypt, and everything is moving in the wrong direction.
That's all coming right up after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat. Joshua Landis, lots of interesting news coming out of Egypt this week. Let's take a look. The Muslim Brotherhood's former president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi's death sentence has been overturned. New stringent laws that restrict the work of NGOs. And perhaps the biggest news is Saudi Arabia has cut off about 700,000 tons of oil deliveries that have been coming to Egypt monthly, every month have been cut off. And Egypt is now having to turn to the IMF, and the IMF is demanding all kinds of cuts in subsidies. And so we've got all kinds of strange and interesting things happening this week in Egypt that are leading to great tensions, economic concerns, and obviously indicating some sort of rift perhaps between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So give us the lowdown on what's happening here.
Well, this is the promise of the Arab Spring gone sour. And what we're seeing from really one end of the Middle East to the other is no money. And Egypt is going bankrupt. It's a country of over 80 million people. You know, you look at the spreadsheet for Egypt and everything is moving in the wrong direction. Very poor country. Doesn't have the money. It's trying to hold it together. The dictator Sisi is cracking down on dissent because people are screaming. They need more. And Saudi Arabia, because of low oil prices, is begin to slash its aid. It's given, it and the other Gulf countries have given over $30 billion to subsidize Egypt since the Arab Spring. And that's kept their nostrils above water. But now they've cut it off. And Egypt has to go to the IMF. That means belt tightening measures, cutting subsidies on sugar, wheat, food oil, and petroleum. This means that people today in Egypt are paying 100% more for sugar. And they're screaming, people who are making $100 a day. And we've got to remember that the average income of an Egyptian is like, you know, $400 a month. So this is real pain and people are complaining. And we don't know, you know, Egypt is shuddering on the edge of financial collapse.
And a crackdown. I mean, they're obviously cracking down.
They're cracking down on dissent. We're seeing Turkey is doing something similar for different reasons, but 300 NGOs were cut just this last week in Turkey. There is, you know, the promise of democracy from the Arab Spring has gone very sour.
But what's behind this, though, with Saudi's decision to do this? Is this over Syria? Are they having a disagreement here?
It is. It's a dispute over Syria and differences. And they've cut $3 billion aid to Lebanon just recently, too. And they're very angry at the Lebanese, who've appointed a pro-Syrian president, Christian president. And so Saudi Arabia is using these political differences as an excuse to cut back on overspending. And it's unclear whether this is really about politics or whether this is really about Saudi Arabia having to bite the bullet and tighten its own belt. But it's pain from one end of the Middle East to the other, economic pain. And that is going to get worse.
So we're seeing it in the streets, obviously, in Egypt.
And
so is this perhaps the beginning of another phase, you know, of the spring?
We hope not.
Spring?
You know, there could be – I mean, Washington is very worried that other countries like Jordan – Egypt, so forth, could collapse and fall into some kind of political violence. That's just what we don't want to see. So everybody has been counting on the Saudis to help subsidize this situation. And the United States has been giving to Egypt. But we'll see whether reforms can turn it around.
Well, Egypt continues to be one of the largest recipients of U.S. aid. So
it
is
does.
That perhaps going to keep those nostrils above water?
Well, and that's the question. The question really is, Can economic reforms and Sisi hold it all together, keep the country together politically, even as he cuts these subsidies?
All right, Joshua, thank you for your insight.
Pleasure.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. I'm on social media at Suzette Grelot. After a short break, I'll be joined by University of Virginia civil and environmental engineer Jim Smith. We'll talk about his work on water and sanitation issues in the developing world. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Jim Smith started his career as a research hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey before joining the faculty of the University of Virginia in 1992. He's the founder of a nonprofit organization called Purimati that works to solve water, health, and societal issues in South Africa. Jim Smith, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
Well, Jim, you're obviously a background in civil engineering and have worked long and hard on issues involving water and sanitation. Can you tell us a little bit about how, as an engineer, you got into this area and obviously started working in areas to focus on sustainable water access?
Sure, sure. You know, I think the issue of water, I became interested in really the influence of family members. I had an older brother who was a civil engineer and got me excited about water issues. But I really did a lot of work on groundwater initially and fluid flow and porous media and cleaning up groundwater. And it wasn't until maybe about 12 years or so ago that I really started to see the bigger problem of global water quality. You know, we've got problems in the United States, but I think they pale in comparison to some of the water issues in the developing world. And that really got me interested in that topic. And really, I sort of had a transition. I did a sabbatical at Princeton University and developed a course called Water for the World. And as part of that course development, I started to really learn myself about a lot of the developing world water problems. And that was really a revelation for me. And that's really changed my career focus for the last decade or so.
So where in particular have you been engaging in this kind of work, and what are some of the, you know, specific lessons you've learned about those areas?
Sure. So, probably one of my first experiences was in the colonias in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. And mainly it was because we were considering doing some work there on water. And I was taken there by some colleagues, and it was an eye-opening experience to see, you know, you just cross the river from El Paso into Juarez, and it's just like night and day. But then my first more in-depth experience was a project with ceramic water filters in a community called San Mateo Ixtatán in the Guatemalan highlands, really a very isolated community. And that's really why they have problems. They're so geographically isolated. And we began investigating the use of these technology called silver ceramic filters that could be made locally in the community, and we could introduce them, and it could be a source of local revenue to the community members. And that really sort of launched a path of research that I've really been on probably for the last 8 or 9 years now.
So tell us a little bit about this ceramic water filter, how that works. What's the technology? Because you said you can obviously build them locally. So I would presume that it's pretty simple technology if you're taking these into developing areas. So how does that work exactly?
Yeah, it's really remarkable, and it's not something I invented. I think our claim to fame is that we showed it worked. But basically, the idea here is that you can take mostly local materials, clay, water, and sawdust, which is normally a waste material, and you mix it together in the proper proportions, and it sort of forms a Play-Doh-like material, right? You can mold it. And then you put it in a filter press. And a filter press, it's just a pot-shaped male and female mold. And when you press it, it comes out shaped like a big pot. After that, the next step is you put it in a wood-fired kiln. And a kiln is basically just a high-temperature oven. So it heats up these pots, these clay pots, to about 900 degrees C. And two things happen then. The first thing is the clay hardens into a ceramic, and the sawdust combusts. So that leaves behind void space that water can then percolate through. So the other innovation then, after it comes out of the kiln and cools down, we use a paintbrush and just paint on a suspension of water that has silver nanoparticles in it. Now, that's our one non-local material, the nanoparticles. But these are little metallic pieces of silver that are about 15, 20 nanometers in diameter. And they're so small, they stay suspended in water. So you can just take the water and paint it on the filter. The water gets sucked into the pore space, and these silver nanoparticles presumably lodge in the pore space of the filter. So now we can take this pot-shaped filter, put it in a 5-gallon painter's bucket, and put a spigot on the bottom of the bucket, and you can pour water in, and it percolates through the filter, and it removes any suspended particulates by physical filtration. And the silver that we put in is an effective antimicrobial agent. So it disinfects the water and kills all the harmful microorganisms that can make people sick. Because it's a pretty simple process, right? I just described the whole process to you. You can teach local people how to make these filters. And then it can become a source of revenue that will sustain the operation of a filter factory. They can sell the filters in the community. That helps them economically. And then it also helps the community with respect to human health.
That's Jim Smith, an environmental and civil engineer at the University of Virginia, and we've been talking about his work providing clean water technology to South Africa. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I've been talking with Jim Smith, who studies water treatment technologies in the developing world and how they impact human health. He's a professor of environmental and civil engineering at the University of Virginia. He's also the founder of a nonprofit organization called Pure Madi. Just before the break, he told me about the clay water pots infused with silver particles they use to disinfect water in South Africa. This is really fascinating. I mean, I'm like picturing this in my head, right? This as you were describing it, the creation of this pot. I'm still a little fuzzy on how the silver part works, but it's really, really fascinating about removing particles. So basically, then water that is retrieved from some sort of local source, whether it's a river or some sort of well or something, can be then obviously poured into this filter and these does it remove everything? I mean, is this the kind of technology that you can use? I guess what I'm getting at is anywhere in the world, depending on, you know, what kind of micro, you know, germs or whatever you would find anywhere in the world. Because I noticed you're also working on this type of technology in South Africa. So you've been working in Central America and South Africa. I mean, so this is a kind of a mobile technology, simple mobile technology that would, you know, clean anybody's water.
Yeah, absolutely. So this, and indeed, there are now filter factories all over the world. There's probably about 40 or 50 that are quite active and successful. In terms of what it treats, though, the two main things it does is it removes turbidity, suspended particles that might make the water look cloudy, and then it removes microbial pathogens. So things like pathogenic E. coli or Shigella or Cryptosporidium. And really, in a developing world setting, that is the number one thing we are concerned about. You know, there's about 2 million children die every year from repeated gastrointestinal infections by these waterborne pathogens. But it's very much transportable. After the work we did in Guatemala, we demonstrated that the filters performed well. And if I can back up, so, you know, when I first heard about this technology, there was a little bit of data from MIT. And what MIT did, they studied the size of the pores in these filters. And they found the pores were about 10 microns in size. Well, an E. coli bacteria is 1 micron in size. So my thought was, you know, there's people teaching this technology to communities. I don't think it works. Nobody knows if this really works. So in a laboratory, that's what got me interested. We showed it worked well in the laboratory. We went to Guatemala, where a local community member was making the filters, and we tested it in homes, and it was working. The final piece of evidence, we went to South Africa, and we conducted a human health study. And what we did is we enrolled 100 people that were HIV positive. And the reason we did that is when you're HIV positive, your immune system is weakened, so you're more susceptible to gastrointestinal infections. 50 of them got filters. The other 50 just kept doing what they normally did. And what we found was that there was a significant improvement in their health, the group that had the filters. So we were able to demonstrate a statistically significant improvement in human health. Based on that, we said, you know, this really works. Let's create our own organization, which we call Pure Mahdi, we can teach people in South Africa how to make and sell these filters. So up until this point, there had never been a filter factory in South Africa. And in the last couple of years now, we've created two factories that are both up and running and producing lots and lots of filters. So we're very excited about that.
This is exciting. And I'm just curious about how it's connected to maybe some of the other activities that are going on in terms of finding water, having access to that water, obviously delivering water to the filter. I mean, I presume this thing, like you said, it goes in a 5-gallon bucket. So it's obviously very portable. You can take it to your water source. But, you know, how is it kind of connected to a broader infrastructure, if you will, of water delivery, water access?
Yeah. So the reason we sort of focus on this idea, you know, if you think about here in the United States, we've got these amazing centralized water treatment plants. They purify the water to a very high level. They send it out in a distribution network. So the water comes right into our homes. It's on 24/7. It's highly regulated. In the developing world, you know, that just doesn't exist in much of the developing world. And there's just not the resources to get that anytime soon. So the idea of the ceramic filters is we're taking away a decentralized approach to water treatment. Let people treat their water in their home right before they drink it. And that way, even if they are drinking from a source that's maybe a relatively unsafe source, if they can treat it right before they drink it, they then have safe water. And of course, we still have issues with supply and quantity. That's going to continue to be issues. But at least the water that they're drinking and the children are drinking is going to be of a high quality, which is making a lot of progress in these rural communities.
Well, as you mentioned earlier about teaching people to make these filters and creating the company that you created in South Africa that makes these filters, I imagine that the educational part of this perhaps goes beyond teaching people how to make the filters, but how to use them clearly, but also that they should use them. So is that all connected together as well, that there's an educational component and that you're working with? I mean, obviously, you're, again, as mentioned, coming from a technical background, but working with social scientists or anthropologists, government officials, others to kind of help get the word out that they need to have, better access to clean water, and that here is something that can do that for them, and then how to implement this so that they are healthier people.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it's one of the big challenges, actually. So many people don't realize they have bad quality water. If the water looks clear and it smells okay, they think it's fine. So one of the things we're doing is, we're trying to stay away from a model where a local NGO comes in and says, we want to buy 1,000 filters and give it to everybody in our community. Because a lot of times if it's given away, it's not valued. And if it's given away without the proper education, it's even less valued. So one of the things that's key in South Africa is the use of influencers. And influencers are things like schools, health clinics, and also churches. So what we're beginning with Pure Mahdi is we're just getting started, so I can't tell you if it's going to work or not. But what we're working to do is we're going into schools and we're donating filters for the classrooms in the schools. And we're also then providing education to the children about why these filters are important. At the same time, we're using the schools as a source to sell filters to the families. So the hypothesis is if the kids come home and say, these filters are great, why don't we have one at home? then that is an incentive for the parents to purchase a filter. And some of that revenue can also then be recovered by the school to put back into their educational programs. Same idea with health clinics and churches. You know, the churches are extremely influential. And if a pastor understands the value of a product, he can recommend that product to his parishioners, and that can be a very powerful sales influencer. And also then he can provide them with education about the technology. So I think that education has to go hand in hand with the filter use.
Well, given what you've said and what you've seen, what you've been doing around the world, what is the prognosis then for the future of access to clean water and better sanitation, health, education, all of the things we've been talking about? The future of water issues. I mean, what are some of the obstacles other than obviously money and just clear access to water source? But what do you see as kind of getting into the way of these types of things being successful in the long run?
Well, I think in general we're getting better. Things are improving. You know, if you look at the Millennium Development Goals associated with water, we have made progress with providing access and to quality water to more people. But obviously, there's still huge numbers of people, probably over 1 billion people, that are not getting safe water. I think the complicating factor, although we're learning a lot in our technologies, we understand we need simple, low cost, affordable technologies. But at the same time, we have this thing called global warming that's hanging over our heads. And in places like South Africa, where we work in Limpopo province, the forecast is that in another 30 or 40 years, they're going to see significantly less rainfall. There's going to be less water available. Things like malaria the prevalence of malaria is going to increase. Things like cyanotoxins from cyanobacteria, as temperatures rise, they're going to be more favorable environment. They grow and produce toxins that are in surface waters. So all these problems we have to start thinking about now and addressing them. And that's sort of, we're coming up with these ideas that a very common buzzword these days is resilient. We need to develop resilient water systems that can still perform at a high level in the face of things like climate change. So I think that's going to be one of our biggest challenges in the next few decades is planning for those changes, which are going to happen in the coming decades.
So thinking about not just sustainability, but resilience over the long term.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jim, for being with us today and telling us about these very important technologies. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Jim Smith, a civil and environmental engineer at the University of Virginia who focuses on water and sanitation issues in South Africa. There's more information, photos of some of his work, and a video about the project online at kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU with support from the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Katie Holland prepares the research for our interviews, Sam Dupre produces the show, Adra Bruls is our digital content intern this semester, and Brian Hardzinski edits the interviews. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Rolotte.